Good morning, everyone. I hope you're feeling well this morning. Feeling more rested, perhaps. Each day, often, each day is different, but certainly people often find that kind of moving past the midpoint of the retreat, there's a kind of a shift and maybe more ease. So I hope that's true for you. Well, whatever's happening is good, because it's what's happening. So I'd like to speak this morning a little bit more about Vipassana practice, so insight, or seeing deeply into the nature, or the seeing that liberates, the kind of seeing that liberates. And link it more to working with the hindrances, which I only had just, barely time to touch on. In the practice of insight meditation, which is, to repeat an important point and to remember, is very intertwined with the practice of steadying and stabilizing, collecting and unifying the mind that happens in the samatha practice. In the practice of insight meditation, what's pointed to in the discourses for us to begin to see in our own experience, so not just understand intellectually, but directly experience in our meditation practice and in our mindful living, is that everything that we can experience through the sense doors, through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and in Buddhism, the conceptual mind is also understood as one of the sense doors. So six senses. So everything that we experience through the sense doors is characterized by three particular characteristics. So the first of these, and they're all kind of interrelated, so we, when we look at one, we're looking at all of them. But so the first and perhaps easiest for most people to connect with is impermanence. And so we see impermanence through the senses of the body. We notice that sensations change. Of course, we notice as we sense the world around us that there's change in the phenomenal world. We this morning the sky was red with the sunrise, and now, it's full daylight. So just those kinds of changes are obvious, and everyone can see those. We also look more deeply into sensations in the body, and we can notice the flow of sensation as we are just feeling the energy in the body, the tingling in the body. We may notice that that if there's a place of soreness in the body, that if we bring attention to it, bring mindful attention to it without contracting around it, that it's not a kind of solid and enduring thing, and it has a dynamic. And so we begin to see that everything's in flux. Everything's in flux. So on the sensation level, body sensation level. And we also look at the phenomena of the mind, and we experience the mind in the body. We experience feelings in the body. We experience, our thoughts and our bodies are connected. If we think of something and an emotion arises, we feel it in the body. So we can notice that these mental phenomena experienced in the mind and in the body are also impermanent, and they're always arising and passing away. So the second of these three characteristics is the word dukkha, and dukkha often remains untranslated because it refers to such a wide range of experience of unsatisfactoriness to suffering. The word dukkha is pointing to is the reality that whatever we experience through the senses can't in any enduring way, in any ultimate way, give us the happiness and the peace and the sense of well-being that we seek. And all beings seek to be happy, contented, to have a sense of well-being. It's innate, it's natural. When we look for food, when the squirrel is collecting food to bring to its nest, it's seeking to sustain itself. It's seeking to be well. When we seek different kinds of activities in our lives that we enjoy, we're looking for a sense of well-being. However we might describe that. And what the Buddha points to in the insight teachings is that although we might find some pleasant and experience, we might find some happiness, it's going to be momentary, that we can't rely on conditions which are themselves changing. Both inner conditions and outer conditions are all changing. And so if we're relying on changing conditions to fulfill our perhaps changing sense of what we want to satisfy us, that we're always going to be frustrated. We're always going to be discontent. We're always going to be looking for more or different. And so the teachings kind of encourage us to stop looking in the wrong place for happiness. And I talked about that a little bit yesterday, about, when I was talking about cravings for sense pleasures, they last, you just get a little bit of hit, a little hit of pleasure, and then, you know, it's gone. That, you know, that new car smell, you know, that people talk about. So it doesn't last very long. So that's the second is, and I'm just going to continue to use the word the Pali word dukkha to refer to that because it can refer to many different experiences. It can refer to loss, the loss of someone we love through death or through separation. It can refer to you know, which can be very, can feel very profound, very deep, and can take a process to come to terms with. If you know, if we don't deeply understand that loss is part of life, and so it can refer on, you know, to one end, you know, to hearing that, you know, we have cancer, and that is going to mean a big change in our lives, and it also refers to coming to deeply understand and accept the reality of death. So all of this is dukkha. And then, on the other hand, dukkha can be, you know, burning our toast in the morning, you know, and the, you know, the irritation that can arise from you know, having to scrape your toast. So from mild irritation to deep sense of loss, all dukkha. Discomforts in the body, dukkha. So dukkha arising a lot, and dukkha also is impermanent. It comes and goes, but it, you know, and not everything is dukkha. If, for example, if we cling to something that's pleasant, you know, as in clinging to sense desires, then that creates dukkha. But if we just enjoy what is pleasant and deeply understand that we can't cling to it, it comes and goes, then pleasant experiences can come and go without dukkha. So anicca, impermanence, anicca is the Pali word, I don't know if I said it, dukkha, and then the third aspect of those three characteristics is the Pali word anatta, not self, no self. This can be a little bit harder for people to understand, because our common sense understanding is that I'm a self, and everything in the phenomenal world has a kind of self-identity. This bowl has, you know, a self-existence, and this building, and, you know, everyone around us. And so what not self points to is the dependent arising of all phenomena, that everything, the one teacher put it in a way that everything leans. Nothing stands up on its own. Everything is leaning on other things. So we can look at the body and we can see that although it seems to be kind of a separate entity. It, you know, we can stand up, we can walk around, we can go wherever our mind directs us to go. If we look more deeply, we see that every moment we're breathing. And so this, you know, we really are earth creatures. We really are, we do need this atmosphere. Just, you know, just as trees need the atmosphere, we need this atmosphere to live. We really are the water, you know, that we see in the river. We're continually, you know, picking up our water bottles and the food also that we eat contains water, and our bodies are 70 or 80% water. We are the food that we eat. Our bones are of the same stuff as seashells, the calcium, the potassium, the trace minerals that had their origin in the death of stars, when they go into, what's that word, where when stars die and implode, and
supernovas,
yeah. So supernovas spread all these trace minerals through the universe, and our bodies require them, and so our bodies are made of, literally, of stardust. So we have a dependent or an interdependent existence. It's not a self-existence. We exist as an integral part of a whole web of life. And so this is not only true of our physical bodies, but of our minds as well. Our perceptions, I alluded to this, I think on Thursday, talking about how perceptions are formed. So perceptions are formed, you know, from the very moment that we're born, perceptions begin to be formed. They're formed by language. They're formed by, in fact, language and perceptions are very connected, and how we language our experience, how we shape into words our experience, affects how we see them. And so the Pali language has subtleties for different kinds of mental states that the English language and most languages just don't have, and how we perceive in French, how we perceive people who are bilingual, perhaps going back and forth between French and English, or between, you know, two other languages, may recognize that somehow the words that shape experiences are different in different languages, and it shapes how we feel the experience, how it takes life in us. And so language and perception, very interconnected. And our perceptions change. We grow up in a household, perhaps, just for example, you know, that has a very more insular way of experiencing life and seeing people from different cultures as other, as different, as perhaps not as friendly a way. And then maybe we leave that context and those perceptions are tested. Those perceptions, you know, we bump up against our own experience and say, and we recognize, oh, different kinds of people, you know, are not, I mean, I don't have to be afraid of different kinds of people. I can, you know, I can learn so much. I can open my mind, my heart. So this is an experience that that often happens, especially in a world that is becoming increasingly cosmopolitan. So perceptions change, and maybe think about how, you know, how your perceptions have changed. You know, we think perceptions are true, you know, that the way we perceive things are the way they are, until we get some new information, and then we may recognize that those perceptions are not so true. So this is our perception, our self-perception, our perception of how, what the world is. This is all part of how we are a not permanent, separate, independent self. It's not that, you know, we should try to get rid of any sense that we have of subjectivity, of being, of experience things in a particular way, unique way, but not to cling to them as being me or mine. You know, to hold them lightly. So these are, as these develop in our Dharma practice, our practice of the Buddha's teachings, we engage with the hindrances in a different way. We engage with craving, craving for sense objects in a different way. We relate to our sensory experiences in a different way. We know that, you know, we may crave to have a sense pleasure, but we deeply know that is not going to really fill any sense of lack that we have within us, that it's going to be just momentary. And so we learn to, you know, see the craving and allow it to rise and pass away. You know, the anger that arises, you know, that might come like a geyser just erupting in our, through, it seems to just fill our whole being with heat. We may recognize that it's temporary, and we may also recognize that it comes from perception. That maybe, you know, we have a particular perception of some event, some person, something that was said, and that perception can change. You know, in the practice last night of when we were just engaging with what was arising in consciousness moment by moment, and inviting metta to kind of connecting with every moment of what was rising in awareness, connecting with metta. You know, maybe you experienced having somebody come into mind that you perceived as an enemy, or a person who was difficult in your life. And with just this quality of metta, to bring a friendliness to that perception. It's a perception. That even though there may have been hurt, even though there may have been wounding, that's not the whole story about that person. That we can perhaps just open, soften around our perception of that person, and include a bit of compassion, a bit more friendliness, a bit more goodwill. Perhaps acknowledging that what was done or what was said that hurt us came from suffering, came from their wounding, came from their fear, their feeling unstable or insecure. And so in insight practice, there is a turning toward our experience of suffering. You know, whether it's sense craving or aversion or just this dullness, this closing down of the mind that we call sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt, and, you know, we can put other words in there, you know, envy and jealousy and self-judgment, it's a kind of aversion, you know, boredom, feeling bored, feeling this ennui in life, nothing ignites us, nothing, we don't connect with things, that's a kind of an aversion. You know, so all of the different subheadings of these categories. We can turn toward the suffering, and we can bring our wisdom, our investigation. So with mindfulness comes investigation, a quality of curiosity, of interest, of wanting to inquire more deeply into the nature of this experience, and bringing investigation, we can see into the anicca, the flow, the flux of what's happening in us in this moment. We can see that our experience is dukkha. We can see that this craving is dukkha. We can see that this anger is dukkha. And we can also see that whatever we're experiencing is anatta, it's not self. It's not me and it's not mine. And that's so profound, just that contemplation of not me, not mine. Not me, not mine. Can we look at something that we think is mine? And can we say, you know, I mean, this is simple. I'm starting with the easy stuff. This is not mine. Okay. So, yeah, I bought it. And, you know, and I use it. But is it, you know, there's this kind of norm that, you know, we possess things. There's a convention. So conventionally, okay, this is mine, you know, and somebody would run up front here and grab my water bottle and run away. I'd say, hey, where are you going with my water bottle? But it's not me, and it's not mine. And we discover this in relationships. We discover this for those of us who have children. You know, we discover, oh, this child is not me. This child is its own person, their own person. And they're not mine. I can't control them. This child is emerging in a way that, as a parent, I can support. We discover this with partners. We discover this with parents. You know, not me, not mine. And we discover it even with our own body-mind continuum, psychophysical organism. You know, one of the contemplations is to deconstruct the body. This body is hair. This body is skin. This body is mucus. This body is water. This body is phlegm. This body is muscle, bone, the contents of our digestive system, and so on. It's not a self. It's not mine. It's come together under certain conditions, and that we call birth. And it comes apart under certain conditions, and we call that death. And in between, we think it's me. But that can cause suffering, clinging to the body as me and mine. And thinking that if we grasp something to adorn the body, or to put in the body, or to gratify some urging of the body, that it's going to give us the peace and contentment we seek, is delusion. So we work with the hindrances with wisdom. We see how they come and go. We see how they arise and pass away. We see how they come from conditions. And they pass away when the conditions change. And they change these habits of mind that we think we're so stuck in. The addictions, the reactivities, you know, they can change. As our conditions change, as we bring new perceptions in, our ways of responding can change. And the Dharma gives us new ways of seeing, new ways of perceiving the body, our relationships, our interactions in the world. And so the Vipassana way of working with suffering, with difficult emotions, with change, is to look at how we're clinging to a sense of that this is permanent, how we're seeing what is impermanent as permanent. We think, oh, this difficult situation is just going to last forever. You know, whereas it actually is changing already, moment by moment, as we're in it. Even just by our investigating it, it's changing. We're seeing what's dukkha as actually fulfilling. And that create suffering. We're imagining that what is dukkha can actually give us some kind of enduring fulfillment. And where we are seeing what is not self as self. And these, when we ask ourselves, how am I seeing, you know, when I recognize I'm suffering here, how am I seeing this as permanent? How am I seeing this as not dukkha? Or how am I seeing this as, you know, something that has a self-existence? That begins to loosen up how we're contracted around that experience. It begins to loosen up how we're gripping that experience. It changes how we relate to the experience, whatever it is. So as we have a short sitting, and as whatever comes to mind, or whatever arises in the body, if there are difficult experiences that arise, whether they're thoughts, emotions, or body sensations, I invite you to apply this Dharma medicine, this wisdom medicine, to experience. And it's a somewhat different approach from just letting go, you know, which is also really so skillful and so wonderful, to let go, come back to the breath, come back to a sense of ease in the body. That's kind of cultivating a samatha way of finding relief, finding some freedom from our suffering, from what is difficult. And this vipassana insight approach is what the Buddha called liberation. You know, so this is liberating in a way that gives us a deeper wisdom, a changed perspective on how we relate to our experience in life. So if you need to release your posture for a moment, please do that, and we'll have a short sitting.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.